Okay, so we can start, and today we have the second lesson talking about transcription factors and moving slowly to enhancers. And okay, so we start with some information that actually yesterday I have not this slide to show you, and is how a factor recognizes a code that is the base pairs in DNA. Okay, just starting from this classical figure, this is a very old book, as you can see, this is the Art of MBOC, that is the Alberts, first edition, second, I don't remember. But anyway, this was the one of the first transcription factors resolved by crystallography, and you see this projection there, and then whenever, I'm sorry for the deformation, it's really, really boring, but anyway, it's okay. Whenever you have a transcription factor bound to DNA, first appreciate that when you look at the space field model, you have quite a complete contact in between the protein and the DNA. Okay, so when you look at this figure, you say, okay, there is no contact; it's just limited. But when you look at the space field, you see that you can appreciate. And also, please appreciate that you have essentially two categories of factors. One of those is the one that recognizes the DNA from one side, completely from one side, as you can see in the figure. And the other one is like the forceps that you saw yesterday. You remember the crab model, in which actually the factors lengths down to embrace the DNA in that way. It's different because things that we never have, or very rarely, we have free DNA in cells. So it's different. If you have a DNA on the surface of a nucleosome, only one side is accessible to factor, not all the molecule. Okay, so it makes a difference. Anyway, so the contact is quite intensive, okay, and sometimes the contact will induce a deformation in the DNA, okay, because you have energies going on, okay, so you have a bending of the DNA, you can appreciate here a little bit, and you also have extreme cases of bending, like this one, that is the TBP, the tetra binding factor, that actually induces a 97 degree or something bent in the DNA, so you can really change the topology of DNA when you have a contact like this one. By the way, this TBP protein is the only protein recognized in the DNA from the minor groove, actually, because it's no longer a minor groove. It's so distorted that the minor groove becomes a really flat surface. Okay. Anyway, so just we saw already this kind of story, so you remember that the stability is given by mainly by ionic bonds with phosphate. Okay, so phosphate and amino something basic groups from the amino acids. While specificity is given by stereospecific weak bonds with bases. Okay, so hydrogen bond or something like this. So what we missed yesterday was the code of interaction. So how a protein recognizes the sequences of bases, okay? So look at this figure. This is the major groove, sorry for the Italian. Most of you don't understand, but I do. I can translate for you. Sorry for the joke. This is major groove, this is minor groove. And make a section and turn the molecule toward your eyes, and you see something like this, okay? This is phosphate backbone, this is ribose sugar, and this is base. Okay, you remember that the bases are flat, just perpendicular to the axis. Okay, so when you turn it, you just see flat bases like this. Okay, and these are the common hydrogen bond between the bases, right? So the minor groove will be here, and we call it minor groove because the distance in between the two ribos is less than if you make the other turn around. So this is the major groove, okay? And if you look, this is a DNA binding protein, And this is an amino acid. Can you recognize it, please? Could you? What is this? Yeah. Asparagine, okay? And this is, as you can see, the amino acid gives hydrogen bonds to positions there, okay? So now let's see the code, okay? So when you have, I made different sections, same story, different sections, and this is a G to C couple. This is a C to G, so the other way around. This is A to T, and this is T to A. Now look at the codes. If you see the positions that are available to the protein, here is a hydrogen bond acceptor. Here you have a hydrogen bond acceptor again. Here is a donor, okay? And this one is a no steric hindrance, in the sense that it's a small atom. Look at the other way around. Here, this is AT couple. You have an acceptor, donor, acceptor, methyl group, so steric hindrance. So the protein over there that tries to recognize here and here has a completely different situation. Okay, the amino acid will bind, depending on this, we call it stereospecificity. Okay, so if you look at the same story, putting also amino acids, you see that this, for example, this glutamine can give the two hydrogen bonds with donor and acceptor. The other way around this is not possible, okay? And here you have, what is this? Arginine, remember? And this is donor-donor, okay? So, sorry, acceptor-acceptor, okay? So this, arginine could not recognize this situation. It does in this case, okay? So just try to imagine all the other situations in which you have this kind of recognition. So the amino acid composition of the alpha helix that recognizes DNA is such that you can have exactly the decoding of a basis. And as I remember to you, is usually not very long. So you have something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 per base pairs that you can recognize, okay? And this reflects actually the binding sites that are more or less this kind of same. Okay, for example, the estrogen receptor, the nuclear receptors, right? It's a kind of Freudian lapsus. you go there, okay? As you can see, it recognizes two next major groups. So actually, the binding site for nuclear receptor is something like 13. Because you have 5 here, 3 here, and then again 5. So the specificity increases because you have extensive recognition of two major groups. Usually it's not the same protein doing this recognition, is a dimer. So one monomer recognizes one, the other monomer recognizes the second, and blah, blah. Okay? Anyway, let's go. So, good, we can come back to our story now. So yesterday we finished the lesson talking about genome-wide identification of binding sites, okay? Let's take again the story. So you remember this is a chip sec or chip on chip, depending on the versions, okay? When we had, sure. Well, we didn't have the NGS technology available, so in the first phase for ENCODE, by the way, they were using something that was called a chip-on-chip, in the sense that this was the same story here before, so you just immunoprecipitate and then you have all the DNA fragments, okay? And in this case, you label them. Is a replication of DNA with dye labeled nucleotides, so you can incorporate this story, and then you hybridize with a microarray. Okay? And again, since you know exactly the genomic position of each of the probes, you can have a map on the chromosome. Okay? In that period also there was something similar to NGS, that was this other flavor that was called chip PET, that means that actually the immunoprecipitated DNA was cloned in plasmids and then concatenated, okay? And this was actually sequenced by normal Sanger. Okay, so you could see the tax of immunoprecipitated DNA in a plasma. Okay, and this was called a chip PET, PET, or chip PET, as you want. So this was the first version, the first phase, and then of course we moved to the when you make TF mapping. So when you make this kind of localization, you cannot use expression microarrays. It is clear to your mind. The most used arrays ever are for expression. So they contain probes against known messenger RNA. Okay? Of course, in this case, since we are mapping transcription factors very rarely bind to coding regions, okay, of a gene. So you have to use completely different microarrays, completely different probes. Okay, the people used essentially two kinds of probes. One was called tiny microarrays, in which you had probes, and this was a release from this. Biotech Affymetrix. They use very short probes, like 24 to 25 nucleotides, and they covered all the genome by consecutive probes. This is why, you know what is a tile in English, is on the roof, okay, tiles. So you cover a complete genome, non-repetitive, of course, with these probes, and then look for the positive probes, okay? Or, and this is a kind of enormous story, Affymetrix released this kind of microarrays in 2005 and was a set of 11 glasses with something like 500,000 probes each. So it was a kind of enormous experiment. Only big institutes like Sanger Institute could actually use this kind of story. Very costly, very expensive. So anyway. There is another version that was really largely used in the labs, so you can probably find articles or papers showing this. That is the so-called promoters microarrays. In that case, the probes were only concerning the surrounding of the TSS of genes. So something like minus 1K going to plus 100, and so you have some probes over the promoter, and this makes the story much smaller than the other one. Okay, so promoters microarrays versus tiny microarrays. Good. So this kind of experiments gives you something very similar to what you see in the browsers today, that is made with NGS. The only difference is the resolution, because NGS gives you a single nucleotide resolution, while the probes, even if very small, like in the case of array Affymetrix, it gives you a lower resolution. That means 25 bases, or 30, or 50, or whatever. Okay, so it's lower resolution. But anyway, this was used to map the transcription factor binding in the genome. And this is just an example showing you two things important. This was from a review in 2009, so he reported actually microarray experiments, chip on chip. And you see here, this is a fragment of chromosome 22, I think, I don't remember. Anyway, and these are mapped genes, as usual with intron and exons, okay, exon and introns and whatever. And this is the peaks relative to different factors, as you can see here. And so the first information is that binding of this transcription factor can be wherever, not only at the beginning of the genes, but more or less wherever in the genome. Okay. And second, that there are two kinds of factors. Factors that are prevalently bound to promoters, like this one, for example. This. Don't remember which one. Okay, this GATA one, that is almost limited to promoters of the genes. Okay, so you see. And this other one that is actually spread away. So you have this. This is the case. E2 factor are the ones that are relative to the DNA replication. There are factors that are interacting with the RB. You probably remember from the cell cycle. Okay. So these factors, A2, F4 and 6, as you can see, they actually bind only to the promoters of genes. Okay. And the other ones, like GATA1 or ZNF and so on, they have many, many peaks in different places. So, in other words, this kind of experiment allows us already to separate prevalently promoter bound factors and prevalently enhancer bound factors. Okay, now go to the ChIP-seq. That is the most common user today. And this is very used today. I mean, there are many, many laboratories running this kind of experiments because they are not really very difficult. So the story, you know, as it's done, okay? And the advantages are that little material is required. Today we can run cheap experiments as little as 500 cells. That's a really thin amount of material. And high resolution, I told you, with base resolution. It's a fully open-ended approach in the sense that you get exactly the result that you want, the spatial resolution, less artifact due to PCR, and blah, blah. And the possibility to multiplex, that means that you can do several experiments at the same time, just tagging the reads as usual, and also can do custom. So there are many biotech companies offering you the experiment. If you have money enough, you can do it. You have not the technology in your laboratory, you can buy it. Okay? So say to some biotech, I want a ChIP-seq of this factor, of these cells. Disadvantages are they are quite expensive, especially if you include the right controls that we discussed yesterday. And the data, of course, a big kind of data. We have many, many, many reads, and so you have to manage in computers, and actually a personal computer is not enough to do it. You have to be a big computer to do it. And it requires bioinformatic analysis, so if you have a bioinformatic working with you, it's good. Try to do it yourself. So. Maybe many of you are more able than I am, anyway. Okay, good. So this is the story. And just to make one point, this is important. Whenever you have a protein of interest, sit down on the DNA, seeing that when you make a chip experiment, okay, you make random fragmentation, okay, because it's a sonication, so it doesn't care the positions. So you get random fragments like this. And you get fragments from both strains, all right? There is no logic. So you can blue are on the positive strain and red is on the negative strain. So actually when you give all your results to the bioinformatic friend that you have in the lab, he will map both of those, and since there is a distance, so you can get prevalently left fragment will be from the positive strain, while red fragment will be from the right side of the protein. You have something like two peaks, not one peak. Okay, so the distribution of the blue ones will be here, and the distribution of the red will be there. So there is a quite complicated statistic analysis on this in mathematics, and then make a single peak out of it. Kind of painstaking analysis. Anyway, making a simplification, you get a position, okay? And the story is that actually you have a frequency plot that is the sum of all the fragments that are there, so we call it peak for the occupancy of a transcription factor. And actually, the problem is that we identify a region where the TF bind, but we cannot identify the motif sequences there. Okay, they are large fragments. Usually, you take something like 500 bases all around. Okay, so you have no indication of which is the actual sequences binding the TF. Can you follow me? Good. So this is the real workload. So you have the map of the reads, reds and blues, okay? The distribution. These are the two peaks that I told you before. And your bioinformatic guy will make an average over there and tell you that the binding region is there. Then you make a peak annotation, that means that you try to identify the region in the genome. If this region has any annotation, it's a gene, a promoter, an answer, whatever else, okay? And you compare with different seq experiments that other people have done in the past, okay? And then you can make the final story, that is the de novo motif analysis. That is a bioinformatic process that goes around the center of the peak, okay? So we can explore to predict the binding sequence, and we have essentially two kinds of bioinformatic algorithms. Are you doing something in bioinformatics at the moment? Do you? No. What are you doing in bioinformatics today? Yesterday. What did?
We're doing sequence alignment for now.
Sequence alignment. Okay.
Maybe.
Yeah, but it's quite similar. Anyway, you will discuss this motif discovery that is. So I just tell you something, and then you will discover better because I'm not able to understand. But roughly, we have two kinds of stories. One is to evaluate statistically the presence of a given known TF binding. So we know that our factor will bind the sequence, blah, 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 blah. Okay? So we explore all the 500, say, fragments that we identified to find this sequence. This is quite easy. We make alignment. It's not very difficult, okay? We tolerate some change, okay? But anyway, it's a kind of thing. And the second story is to make de novo analysis. So you are not biased by known motif, okay? You just explored all the 500 base pair fragments that you identified to find words, say, sequences, small sequences, that are more frequent than in the rest of the genome. It's like exploring a book for words that are frequently tell, okay? For example, I don't know, you can explore different pages and find that in one page the word war is repeated several times. So you can probably imagine that this page, this chapter, is talking about war. Okay, so it is the same. So there are algorithms that explore the sequence and say, okay, here there is a higher frequencies of 80, 80, 80. Okay, and this will be a novel motif, maybe, or the motif that your factor is bound to it. Okay? The problem is, the additional problem is that the TF binding motifs are not fixed. So, we don't know virtually any factor in between the 2,000 and so factors that we know. No one of them recognizes fixed sequence. Say, okay, the recognition motif is CAG, CAT, okay? It's not like this. They recognize similar motif, okay? So they tolerate changes in between. So in other words, even if you make a pure biochemical assay, like the one that I told you yesterday, the SELEX, so the selection in between a completely random library, you will find a library of different motifs that can recognize the factor, okay? So when you put all together, you found something that is called a matrix. I'll show you. just to show you. Okay. Maybe it works, maybe. Let's see. It doesn't. Oh yeah, it works. Well, there are many, as you will see in your textbook, there are many databases of transcription, but you can go and see what is the story. Let me Google it out. And this is the, okay. There is a connection, maybe, let's say that it's charging. Do you have any difficulty in connecting to this morning? That's okay. Okay, I don't know. Maybe in a minute, so we can move on and then see whether. Okay. So what you find is a matrix. A matrix means that you have positions, okay, in which some letter is more frequent than the other. Let me see. Okay, so imagine that you have identified 1,000 sequences, okay? Then you align them, okay, on the most similarity. You find the most similarity. For example, in this case, TGAC is fixed. So you align all the sequences to have this TGAC, the same position. And then you see what is in the side positions. Okay? So you find, for example, that the right side position of the sequence can be either a C or a T. Because the transcription factor is able to recognize these four bases absolutely. Okay, so they are needed completely, but this one can be tolerated. So you cannot have a G, you cannot have an A, but you can have either a C or a T. Okay. Then again, the sixth should be again fixed C. So no choice. But the seventh can be either an A or a G, but with more preference for the A. Okay. So this is the logic of transcription factors. And this is my favorite transcription factor, the estrogen receptor element. And you see that again, you have some positions that are quite required, like this G and the C, this A. And look at this, these are completely symmetrical. If you have an A here, you have a T here, if a C here, you have a G there. And blah blah. Okay, it's completely similar. Why? Because it's a dimer. So you have exactly the same sequence on the left side, right side. Okay. So other positions are completely different. Look at the first, the middle. You remember this was the minor groove in the figure. So no choice in between. Okay. So this is completely different, and then you have again the story. So this is what we call a logo representation. It's called S logo, and S stands for sequence logo, and it comes from something that we call a positional weight matrix. That means that it measures the weight of each position in a motif. Yes?
If you have to say what is the sequence that back from my transcription factor, say the base more express, or we say the two base. For example, in
AP. Yeah, I understand what you mean. Yeah, sometimes in the older. Okay, today you always will find this kind of S logo representation in the papers because it's much more informative than the other ones. Okay, so it's good. But in older papers, you can see something like this. Wait, something like, for example, G, C, then AT. Okay, they say like this. Or, for example, as we told sometimes, H, that means no G, or whatever. So it's a kind of a representation, but actually this is not very informative, because it tells you something, but not all. So if you have as log, it's much better, of course. And this log actually is taken from a very complicated mathematical, not complicated for me, I mean, elaboration of the matrix. Maybe that we can get it, I don't know. But, okay, yeah, you see, so what you have to do is to measure. Can you see it from the last rows? Can you see that? Sorry. Okay. Is any better? So imagine that you have aligned different sequences. Okay. So you make a PFM, that means a positional frequency matrix. That means that you have just. Can you follow that? You can just to count for each basis how many hits you have in your alignment. Okay, you have in the first position here, you have 3 times the A, 2 times the C, 1 time the G. Okay, can you follow? I see strange expressions from you. So I have to increase a little bit more. Okay, these are the sequence aligned, and this is a frequency matrix. Okay? Have you got the point? I count. First base, I see 3 times an A, 2 times a C, 1 time a G, 4 times a T in the first position. Then I count the second position, and I found 6 times an A, 2 times a C. Okay, of course, if you have smaller numbers like this one, it's not very significant, but when you have a cheap stick experiment, you have thousands of sequences to count, so it becomes quite strong in terms of statistics, okay? And this is the frequency matrix. Then you can convert it with this formula here, that is a mathematical formula that I don't understand. You can convert in PPM, that is a positional probability matrix that tells you what is the probability of finding the space in each position. Okay, and this you elaborate in a statistical mode, and you find what is finally this position weight matrix, that is this one. Okay, so in other terms, you have the weight is the quantity of information that you get from the matrix, and this is exactly what is plotted in the S logo. Okay. Good. Then you ask the bioinformatics professor to explain you better that. Okay. Good. Let's see if we have found the database. No, the gateway timeout. What it means? I don't know, yesterday was working correctly. In attesa di risposta. It doesn't work anymore. Okay, no problem. We'll see. No worry. It was just a database. So we resolved this point, and then moving to the next is the quotient. The chipstick experiment, so identify TFBS, not DNA-TF interaction. This is another level of confusion that you get from data from ChIP-seq, because you get several fragments, you're looking for the motif analysis or whatever else, and then very often you find the motif of your factor, but not always, and this is not really very significant most of the times, and very often you have also other motifs, you will see in a minute. Why this guy? Because actually, transcription factors have shown in the past to have a. This is complex, of course. This is not a mysterious one. I'm sorry, it's a mistake. They show a complex protein-to-protein interaction network. In other words, each transcription factor is able not only to interact with DNA, but also with other proteins. Okay, and in between, among this. Proteins, also many other transcription factors. So they interact with each other, okay? So also with co-regulators, co-activators, enzymes, whatever. So a complicated network of protein-protein interaction. So you may have this kind of situation here. You may have either that you find In a place you find three proteins because there are correctly the motifs by the DNA motifs binding each of them. Okay, this is a correct situation, let's say. But you can have this kind of situation here. So this factor, for example, this red factor here, it doesn't bind DNA here. It only binds to the protein, the blue protein. Okay, same story with the yellow one. It binds the other factor here. Okay, so you can have, if you chip this blue one, okay, for example, if you chip it down, since the fragments are quite wide, okay, you find also the other proteins, okay, vice versa. If you, for example, you chip the red one, you will chip these fragments that are directly bound by it, but also these fragments here that are bound by the other factor. So this is a kind of confusing story, okay? Just because when you make a, you remember that the first step is to take the nuclei and make formaldehyde cross-linking. So you cross-link everything. And then you get a. And also, there aren't methods to avoid this kind of confusions that are difficult in the sense that you can take a factor like this one, then precipitate the, immunoprecipitate the complex, and then try to trim away the DNA. Trim away with the DNAs, okay? This quite inefficient process. And, anyway, some authors try to do it. Anyway, most of the chip-seq data are this kind of general thing, and they will always be accompanied by other story. Okay? So whenever you have a precipitation, actually this figure that I showed to you as an example of S-logos actually comes from a, as you can imagine, from an estrogen receptor chip. So people immunoprecipitated the estrogen receptor from one breast cancer cell line, okay, get thousands of fragments bound to estrogen receptor, then make this kind of motif identification, and they didn't find only the estrogen receptor element, as was the simplest theory, but they found many other elements. That means that actually, close to the estrogen receptor, other factors bind, either as a protein-protein contact or as a direct binding to the DNA or whatever. Okay, so that's the story. Okay. Now, going to, this is a kind of general situation for transcription factor binding. You have seen that actually you recognize short motif, but usually this small cis element have a very high specificity in regulatory region. And this is done because first, almost all TF binds a dimer, trimers, or whatever, and second, almost all the time TF, they cluster, so they bind together with a region. So we will see in the following that the TF function follow the, I invented this actually, but it's okay, you can take it for true. This COCO-CO rule, that means combinatorial binding, as you have seen before, compositional binding that will increase fine-tuning, and cooperativity that will determine transcriptional outcome. And in the following, I try to explain you. And I try to explain you with a beautiful history that was actually gaining a Nobel Prize several years ago. Maybe you know, and the early development of Drosophila. Have you ever heard about it? Never? Really? That was a kind of very funny story. Okay, you, if you are interested in this story, you can find a free book here. It's the developmental biology book of Gilbert, who is a very important person. And actually, these guys, Lewis, Christian Nielsen, Follart, and Virchow, have received the Nobel Prize in 1995. For the discovery, and there is a YouTube movie on the web by Eric Virchow, so it's nice to see if you want to just to spend half an hour of your time to see something very funny. Anyway, let's go. This is Drosophila, and the Drosophila, as you know, is an insect. It has many, many oocytes. The oocyte is fertilizer, as always, and then has a very quick development in the embryo. So it takes few hours to reach this stage, that is the segmented embryo, let's say, okay, in which there is already the plan of the adult, because the segments are already they have already a fate that is very well written in themselves. This is the head, thorax, and abdomen here, okay. So this, they are insects, so they go through the etching. That is, they make a larva, and they make a pupa, and then metamorphosis, they get the final other morphology, but I don't want to go through. We concentrate on this early development, okay? So this is very special, very particular. Can I turn off the light for a moment? Okay, this is just a stain of DNA in Drosophila early embryo. So this is an egg. This kind of very long, elongated oval here. And this is just the pronuclei that are starting to... They are fused, the two paternal and maternal pronuclei are fusing. So you say only one nucleus. Then you go through a number of mitoses that are extremely quick, extremely. So they take only a few hours. And there are something like 13 cycles, very quick, very rapid, and this very special because you do not have cellularization. So the nuclei are disrupted, the membrane, then you have replication of DNA, mitosis, replication of DNA, mitosis, and you never make new cells, only nuclei. Okay? So this is also the reason why it's very quick. And this follows the rule 2 by 2 by 2 by 2. So at a certain point you have at a 10 cell cycle 512 cells. Exactly the 12 by 2 by 2 by 2. Okay? And these nuclei are there. You see there. And then when you arrive to this stage, the nuclei start to move from the center of the egg and going close to the membrane. Okay? So you can see the nuclei here, close to the membrane, okay? And at this point, you have a phenomenon of cellularization. So the membrane of the egg make furrows in between the two nuclei, start to get inside and then close them. So you have cellularization, that is here. In the scheme, it's easier to see. Okay, so you are right here. This is mitosis, this is called a syncytium, of course. And then you go there, and you see the furrows of the membrane that are getting inside, and then you have cellularization. This is very important, not only because it's quick, but also because the nuclei, until this stage, they are exactly in the same cytoplasm. Okay? So they share the cytoplasm, as a matter of fact. Okay? So, this is electron microscopy. You can see very well the story. So this is a syncytial blastoderm, and then you start cellularization here, and you have the cellularized blastoderm over there. Okay. So this cellular blastoderm consists of 6,000 cells. Okay. So this kind of cellularized blastoderm, and until that stage, there is no transcription from the nuclei at all. Okay, so all the materials, let's say, that allows all this mitotic repeated cleavage and synthesis of DNA and mitosis again and blah blah is due to the proteins and RNAs and whatever that is in the egg, originally in the egg. Okay. This is the address where you can see the movie. Actually, it's a lesson. Okay. So what happens next? What happens next is this, that when the embryo, the 6,000 cell embryo is like this, you start gastrulation. You remember what is gastrulation? As one point in the embryo, cell starts to move inside. And this will give the original layers, okay, ectodermal, mesodermal, endodermal, and whatever. So this is a migration inside. And I signal to you an important fact, that is that whenever the cells go there, inside, they lose epithelial phenotype and they acquire mesenchymal. This process is the EMT that we have talked about already. It is exactly the process of metastasis in invasion cancer, okay? Good, so this is a starting acceleration. And you have also another furrow here, the cells here, also migrate inside. So you see on the surface of the embryo, you see two furrows. One is the ventral, whoop, that is going inside. And the other is a furrow that is separating what would be the head of the embryo from the rest. Okay. Okay, this is particular and actually continues this stage until you start to see segmentation. So several furrows create, and so you have segments, okay? And this is the pupa, and you see that actually this is exactly the plane of the adult already, okay? So the problem is, okay, this is good to see, and if you go to this movie by Vishal, you will see the cells moving through the furrow. It's very interesting. Anyway, okay, this is the following. So this segmental appearance is kept until the adult. If I stain different stage embryos with a box protein, like this engrailed protein here, you see that this is a 5-hour embryo has already segments of expression. So the expression is localized to segments. This is a 10-hour embryo, segments. And then you go to the adult segments. So exactly this kind of organization. Good. So coming back to our story, and we go there, and there is one important question. If you go there, you start to understand why, and this is the very interesting problem in bio. This is just screenshots from the lesson. This guy is Wishaus. Told you. Okay, it's not making. Yeah, making this small embryo. Okay, so you see that why in the world we have this situation here. And this is the starting of the head furrow, okay? So when the cells start to migrate inside, okay? So the question that they addressed, he and the colleagues addressed, is why the cells start to make something different from the others? This is an important biological point, because, mitosis, we know the mitosis. Okay, migration, the cells may be a physical phenomenon because too many, they go to the membrane. It's okay, good, but now why? One cell decides to start to move, and the others do not. That's an important point in biology. What makes this cell to be different from the other one? They are common in the sense cytoplasm. So this is the discovery for which they received the Nobel Prize. Because trying to answer this question, they have found a very interesting, very, very interesting story. So they have found that, I told you that until the stage of 10 divisions, there is no transcription by the nuclei. So they are entirely dependent from what it was before. They discovered that many of these substances that are in the egg, in the original egg, okay, this is the original egg, they are not evenly distributed through the egg. For example, they discovered a protein that is called bicoid that has a different distribution, is a gradient distribution. So if you look in the egg, The concentration of the bicoid protein is very high here, that will be the anterior to the head, and very low in the tail. Okay? So if you go back to this figure, this is the quantitative representation of this distribution. This is a protein. And after this discovery, they started to look for other proteins that were not evenly distributed in the embryo, and they discovered several other proteins that are also typically uneven. Okay, and they discovered Hunchback and Crapple, that is from the red one, that are actually distributed in a different way. Okay. So finally, when you have, these are already developed embryos, so that I already said, this is the original one, one cell, one nucleus. Yeah. These are already cellularized embryos, okay? And then if you go to the cellularized embryo, you stain with other product like this, paired and runt genes. This is a fish, so it's a RNA distribution. RNA detection, you see that they are segmental, completely segmental. So the paired RNA is only in these cells, while the runt is only in the adjacent cells. This is spectacular, in my opinion, spectacular. Because you have to understand how two cells that are adjacent to each other, one decides to express one gene and the other one express another gene. That's quite fantastic. So, and this accompanies completely the furrow. Okay, if you look at this, exactly the cells that decide to start to migrate inside. Okay, so what is the story? The story is that we have this kind of distributed factors. This factor is quite easy to understand, because if this factor is a transcription factor, and it is, okay, it will have a differential effect, okay, on cells that are in the head and in the tail. So this will turn on some genes, and this will not, because it's a lower concentration. So this cell start to express another gene, okay? And if this gene is a repressor of another gene, you will have two gradients. Then the sum of these two gradients, if they are transcription factor, they can induce other genes to be expressed following their regulatory activity. So here, for example, in these cells, you have high level of the red one, low level of the green one. Result, this this light green factor will be repressed. Okay, this is usual, all the time. Come si fa già col messaggio? Che messaggio? Non ci vedo niente. Non posso rispondere. Okay. I say, okay, then in the middle region here you have equal concentration of the two factors, and they induce expression of this black factor here, black gene, okay, and vice versa. And then you can sum the effects. So you have summing effects that from an original gradient or something. Okay? This is segmentation. This is really nice. They discovered it. It's a nice story. Okay. So, this is why these cells decide, as you can see, and are exactly the cells here. They decide to move, because these two genes, probably they determine the phenotype, different phenotype of the cells, okay? And they probably secrete some factors, the communication between them, something, and so they start to move. Okay? Now, we have primary genes that are distributed anterior to posterior, the bicoid, Hunchback, that's funny names, that are derived from the mutant, of course. We studied all these by mutants. So, just making mutants and then looking how they were disrupting the development. This is giant, the secondary gene, because it depends on the gradients of the primary gene. So you have segmental expression of giant, segmental expression of cripple, and then you move on. So where do these signals come from? Because I understood that there's gradient, but where? Why the whole site has a gradient? Just because this is established during the oocyte maturation. Okay? It comes from the mother. And we have two systems. One is the anterior-posterior system, and the other one is the dorsal ventra. Okay? And this comes because the oocyte is not alone. The oocyte grows and matures in the follicle. The follicle cells are divided in follicle cells here and the nurse cells there. And they secrete something. Okay? So they secrete something toward the egg. And since the anteroposterior axis is already established there. Okay? So, but is that a protein production? So, meaning, we know that this bicoid factor was a protein. They discovered it as a protein that is differentially distributed. Okay? Gradient distributed. But they discovered also that this protein is not secreted by nurse cells as a protein, but as RNA. So these cells, they produce an RNA, bicoid RNA, here. Okay, they secrete in the oocyte, and this RNA is inactive. It's anchored to the anterior part of the egg. It's anchored by other proteins that keeps it there. And it stays there for the following 10 divisions, okay, until the starting the translation machinery works, okay, and produce a protein. The protein is not anchored, but since the source of the RNA is still anchored, it will be expressed over there and diffuses. And this is the reason why you make a gradient. RNA stays there, translation is there, protein starts there and then diffuses away. Okay, so this is the general story, and is. What happens in all the morphogen, actually. So if you study a book of embryology, you will find tens of cases like this one. Okay, the source of a factor that can be a diffused factor or a secreted factor or a cell-to-cell communication factor in the case of bicoid. And then the response of the cells in different places depends on the quantity of the factor. This is another extremely important discovery. So in biology you have never on-off. On-off results only for combinations, as in the case of stripes in the embryo. Combination of factors. But when you have one single factor, the response that the cells has to a single factor is always proportional to the amount of the factor. And this is really a lesson that we have to learn. So information in biological systems is quantitative. It's qualitative, of course, but it's also quantitative. So a cell that responds to high concentration makes makes a response that is different from another cell that is exposed to low concentration. And this is because the genes, these are three genes, okay, they have different sensitivity to the factor, okay? So when here, for example, you have a very low signal, very low concentration of the signal, okay, you activate a small quantity of transcription factors, and in that case, only gene C is sensitive to this low quantity of that factor. So you have turning on only gene C. On the contrary, this cell that is exposed to very high concentration of the factor, okay, has a signal, many, many transcription factors active in the nucleus, and they will turn on also genes that have a very low affinity for the factor itself. So this is an important lesson. We are studying, as I tell you, for the 10 times we stop it. 10 times we are studying estrogen receptor. Estrogen receptor is a normal factor. It drives the development of the mammary gland and whatever. Normal, quiet, a good factor. And when it is overexpressed, so the quantity of transcription factor is over and over and over, several fold, makes a cancer. So in cancer, in breast cancer cells, we have very high amount of unregulated estrogen receptor. It will induce a response that normally doesn't. But this, listen again, okay? So the quantity is important. Can we stop for a minute? Okay, so we can start again. Can I? May I? Yes. So just this is just a message for people who are not present this morning. Recording. I strongly suggest you to see the this YouTube movie from Eric Wishaus, because you will understand everything in figures over there. Okay? Good. So now, going back to our problem, because this was a nice biological story, but it's not concerning an answer, right? So we are going to understand why this gradient and this tribes expression will determine development in some way and expression of the genes in a differential way. So the taking from your Levine, that was the very original textbook that you saw, there was a figure one that was just showing the same story that we are discussing today. So the stripe expression of genes. And this is a very famous experiment. That was the Eve gene that, as you can see from this fish experiment, it concerns stripes of cells. So only stripes of cells do express it. And when people went to try to understand why, they characterized all the locus, okay, and find out a very important story that actually is very much the same that we see today in our genome, as you can probably make the parallel with what we said yesterday. That is, the Eve gene is there. Okay, so the transcription unit is only limited to this region here. And in the locus, in the left and on the right, there are several enhancers. So wherever you see E, means that there are blocks of regulatory region. Okay, and people started to make funny experiments. Like in Drosophila, it's not that difficult because you can make a homologous recombination, and then since the development is so quick, you can have an answer in a week. Okay, you can make knock it down, for example, knock it out eggs, and then have the flies flying after a few days. So it's very, as a genetic system, is better than an elephant or something like this. So they started to make this kind of experiment, and they started to make dissection of all the regulatory regions around, and they found that whenever they eliminated one of those enhancers, you lose expression, but not of all the cells, but only, for example, if you eliminate this EF2 enhancer, you only lose expression of it in this stripe, or other situation that you can imagine. Okay, so the final story is that we have different enhancers that are driving the expression in different cells. And this, if you translate this concept to what we saw yesterday by ENCODE experiments, in which we have genes that are embedded in tens of enhancers, can start to give you an answer. Why there are so many enhancers for one gene? Okay. Now try to the mechanism. Why this enhancer will direct here, and why this enhancer will direct here, and so forth. But you remember that we have gradients. So from the story that we saw before, we have gradients, anteroposterior gradients of factors that will determine secondary gradients, as you remember, peaks of factors and blah blah, and then tertiary gradients of other factors and blah blah. So actually, transcription factors that are expressed in these cells are not the same. You have different factors, different concentration of factors, and also different combinations of factors. So if you look at the composition of these announcers there, you find that, okay, this is just the same story with another slide, but this is exactly the same story. This is protein. It's protein staining. This was RNA staining. This is protein staining. Just the same, okay? And if you go there, okay, and you look for the gradients of the different factors that you have in the different segments of the embryo, and you can understand. For example, this is one of the stories. Hunchback is a repressor. And why this repressor will work differently on two different genes. This is a CRPL, this is giant, and these are enhancers from CRPL and giant genes. And why this factor works differently? From a quantity problem, because this is the CRPL enhancer, this one, has few sites, only three sites for the Hunchback transcription factor, okay? And so it requires higher level of the factor to be repressed. On the contrary, giant has many other factors, you see seven sites, so it requires less transcription factor to be repressed. And that's a very easy story. So if you have gradients, you will express CRPL and giant with these kind of stories. Okay, so this is a quantity. And other stories is that because you have compositions, okay, this is the stride 3, this is an answer of stride 4, and you see that the number of sites, motif, that will bind to nerves or Hunchback are different. Okay, so just a combination of the two factors that are quantitatively different, they give different results. Okay, in the stripes. Okay, and you have an answer with a repressor there, so you will turn off the gene. You have an answer with the same factor bound to it, but to a different enhancer. You will have on response and so on. Okay, so that's the story. Or in other cases, you have sites that superimpose, like this one, in which you have a CRPL site that is superimposed to the giant site. Okay, so depending on which factor is expressed, we turn on or off the gene. Okay. So making the story short, just to tell you that, of course, this is also, you remember that I told you that the enhancers are distance and context independent. This is completely true, because if I take this stripe 2 module that you saw that is the one that directs expression here, you take it out from the original chromosome and you clone in a reporter gene. You remember reporter gene? Yesterday we discussed it. Then you make a transgenic fly with this reporter and you will be expressed only in one stripe. So it means that this is decontextualized because you put in another gene in another reporter and it works. Okay. Good, so this is the dorsal ventral system. So there is a signal coming from the follicular cells here in the maturation of the egg. This is a different signal, just to tell you that it's not always RNA or something. This is a transmembrane receptors. Okay, so it's a transcription, it's a growth factor, so a soluble cytokine that hits from the follicular cell, hits the cells, the surface of the membrane of the egg here, and gives a signal like this. Okay, so you have, oh my God, the eggs, right? Okay, this it's quite interesting because this is a signal that is very similar to human signals. That is the inflammatory signals like this, and this this dorsal factor is the homologous of an FKB in human. It usually stays in the cytoplasm, and when the signal arrives, you have degradation of the inhibitor, so dorsal can go to the nucleus and acts as a transcription factor. Analogy complete with the NFKB situation. And as you can see, this is the gradient of the ligand that in Drosophila is called spathyl. Okay. And because the cells, the follicular cells here, they secrete this kind of, they express this kind of ligand. Okay, so only these nuclei are hit by this dorsal transcription factor. Okay, actually there is diffusion, but not that much. So actually, only these nuclei will be dorsal protein released to nuclei. You see that? Okay, good. So this, the presence of dorsal, will turn on secondary genes. Okay, that are called SOG, rhomboid, and twist. But since the enhancers of these three genes are differently composed, okay, SOG has four optimal dorsal binding sites. That means high affinity, okay, for the dorsal transcription factor. This rhomboid has only one high affinity dorsal binding site. It is an enhancer. And the twist has only two low affinity sites over there. Okay, what happens is that in these cells, in the real ventral cells, you have a high signal because you have high concentration of the protein. So you will twist on, so the gene will be turned on only in these cells. While the rhomboid here, they have one high affinity site, so they are sensitive to even to lower concentration of dorsal, that is in these cells. Okay? And finally, the SOG one, that is the one has a very high affinity site there, it feels also very low concentration of dorsal, and is turned on also in these sites. So you make three different layers of cells. This one will have twist, rhomboid, and SOG. These cells will have no twist, but they will have rhomboid and SOG. And these cells will have only SOG. Again, gradient determining different expression of transcription factors. And this different combination transcription cell will drive the cells to do different things. You remember what happens to the ventral embryo? Ventral furrow. The ventral furrow is one of the gastrulation points. What is twist? Do you know what is the twist? Has the same name in human.
It's one
a repressor of epithelial phenotype. Primary is a repressor of E. cadherin expression. So it makes E. cadherin stopping here in the cells. No contact between the cells, and the cells starts going inside. Okay, very nice example again of what a gradient of morphogen can determine as a response in the story. Okay, so snail expression is here twist, and then this will. The snail is another repressor of the epithelial genes. Okay. So, the second lesson that we take here is that, from all the story here, is that the transcription factor act in a combinatorial way. Okay? So, is that true? I mean, this comes from Drosophila. As probably you know, Drosophila insects are very quite far away as a machinery from vertebrates and from humans, of course. And so we may ask if it's the same story in our genes, that is probably more relevant to our story, medicine, whatever. And this is quite the same, in the sense, first, that you have all the enhancers that we know are, indeed, they are cluster motifs for different factors. So in all our genome, you never found a situation like this, where the small colored square are individual motif for one transcription factor. You never found this kind of distributed random situation. Always see clustered motifs. That means more than one factor in the same place. Okay? That's the story. We have several very nice examples of this that explain to you the second call. So you don't only have this cooperation, but you have also what is called compositionality. That means that not only you have an answer in which you have different motif for different transcription factor, but also that the order of these motifs is determined, is fixed. Okay, so you always find factor A, factor B as a second, factor 3 as a third, and blah blah. And this is because there are protein-to-protein interaction between them, and cannot be exchanged because the surfaces of the protein, as you know, are not equivalent. So one protein A has to be oriented in a way such that it is able to recognize the second one and the third one, and blah blah. Okay. So we have a very clear example in human that this interferon beta gene that has a typical enhancer somewhere, okay, that binds to different factors. It binds to an FKB dimer here. It's an interferon, so it responds to inflammation. Okay, so inflammation and FKB activation and gene expression. Then there's this IRF that is a interferon response factor, and this is a June ATF dimer. Actually, they are proteins of the same kind. They are basic zipper leucine proteins. Okay, so they bind in a compositional way because the sites are there. Here you have a dimer, a tetramer, and there's another dimer. And the protein interact each other only because the DNA is not linear, but it is bent like this. So it brings the protein together like this. Okay. And why it is bent? Because there is an additional protein that is an architectural protein, we say. That is this HMGA1 that it binds to DNA and it turns it, bends it. Okay. It makes a bend, like the TBP that you saw before. So actually, when you have everything together, you make a complex, that is this complex here, you see, in which the protein interact in a very specific way between each other. You can make an EMSA analysis. You remember what is an EMSA analysis? Gel shift analysis? Yesterday we studied that. You put the labeled DNA fragment, and then you can add proteins and see if the fragment is electrophoretically shifted up because it's a higher molecular weight. Okay. You can make this kind of analysis and you see clearly. Okay, this is this requires to have a presence of a nucleosome, but it's another story. So you have to have the DNA with the nucleosomes. It's a kind of catalyzer. But anyway. So the free is there, okay? Then you add, for example, the HMGI, that is the protein that bends the DNA, you get a higher molecular weight complex. If you add the IRF1, you get a high molecular complex. If you get ATF2, you get another high molecular complex, and so on. If you add all of them, you see, this is what you see with the three factors here. And then when you add a HMG1, that is actually a light protein, you have all the complex form. So people call it this kind of big complex enantiosome. That means all the proteins together with the enantiosome. And from the functional point of view, it works only when it's complete, before it doesn't work. Okay, let me look at the particular story. This is interesting to see it. because the people crystallized it. So you can see here the proteins. This is ATF2-CJUN, that is a leucine zipper basic protein here. Then you have this IRF3A, 7B, they are different IRF, but same family, and they bind in four proteins to the DNA here. And then you have this NFKB heterodimer, P50, REL-A, that are bound to this element here. And if you look at the sequence, as you can see, it's a small sequence. It's not a big piece of DNA. It's something like 60. This is a human. It's only 60 nucleotide long, so it's not very, very long. And this is the binding site for ATF and JUN. This is the site for IRF, I see, repeat. As you can see, there is variation. This is 4A, this is 3A and 1G. Variation, as I explained to you before. Okay, and then this is an FKB site. That's quite. And look at the conservation. This is human, this is mouse, and rats, and this pig, horse, and co. here. And you see that actually there is very high concentration, very high conservation. Very high phylogenetical conservation of the sites. Okay. So just to make a parenthesis, this phylogenetical conservation is one of the way we look at the genome originally. Because in the intergenic space in which there was no annotation the years before, there was no many way to see the sequence. And so we made this kind of alignment between different vertebrates. And when you see a very conserved element, probably it works. It's functional. It is, as you can see here. Okay. So. Good. So, just to go out a little further. Okay. So this is what I call compositionality, in the sense that you have really to compose like a puzzle, the story in a correct way to have the response. Then the third, the other core is the combinatorial that we have seen already. But sometimes this combinatorial activity is not due to the fact that you have several factors to the answers, but to the protein-protein interaction, as I told you before. Very often, you have one factor, like in this case, OCTA1, that binds to its own element, an answer, promoter, whatever. And then the kind of activity that it has, like transcription or activation or repression or whatever, is actually mediated not by other DNA binding proteins, but by protein-to-protein interaction. Actually, OCTA1 has two surfaces, IF1 and IF2, that means interaction factor 1 and interaction factor 2, that will interact with different proteins. So depending on the kind of protein that is expressed in a cell, we say the partner of the protein, partner, it will have different responses, transcription and activity. And this is SOX2, same story. This is SOX2 bound to the element with different surfaces, IFA, IFB, and they interact with different proteins there. So you have different response. Okay? And the last core is cooperativity, in the sense that if you're looking for effect, transcriptional effect, you always have a cooperative effect, in the sense that, for example, you have a reporter here, you have a minimal promoter here, and you have three motif binding for three different transcription factors there. So you transfect over a cell, and then you transfect separately the factors which bind to each of them. Okay? So you transfect known, you have just the minimal transcription for promoter. I call it one, just an example. Okay? Then you transfect factor A that will bind to this element here, and you have transcription 2. So you have a small effect in transcription. You transfect TFA plus TFB, you have three. Transfect factor C, you have two again. But when you transfect all of them, you have 25. It's not additive, it's cooperative. Okay, so you have, and this you see many, very, very, very often in all the systems that you can analyze in papers published. Okay. Okay. I told you that this kind of compositionality, this kind of story, is that frequent in the genome? Is another question that we can address. I don't want to really to go inside this problem, but just to get an answer. And the answer is yes. Usually they are really in ordered arrays, this kind of motif. Okay, they are not mixed up. And this came very clearly from the ENCODE studies. As you remember, ENCODE studied incredible number of transcription factors by ChIP-seq in an incredible number of cells. So they had a kind of general map of this. And one of the 30 papers that was published in 2012 was this guy that was reporting 119 transcription related factor in 450 distinct experiments in different cell lines. So these guys tried to put everything together. Of course, again, they couldn't do it in a laptop computer, probably, or in iPad or something. They had very credible power of computing for doing this kind of story. But anyway, they got it, and this is just the story, okay. So they had something like 7.5 million pigs in all the experiment, okay. And, let me look at the results. This is the results that denounce a large number of promoters, blah, 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 we know already. So I told you this kind of combinatorial and compositional story. So what they saw very clearly from this examining by this older story is that the transcription factor binding sites, and this color means different transcription factor binding sites, they are usually follow this compositional rule, in the sense, for example, you find this blue and followed by yellow and followed by green, frequent. Only rarely you found something like red and yellow and green, okay? Or you find blue and yellow and green, frequent, not the other way around. Okay, so they are really like this, okay? Just to show this is the matrix. The matrix, they realize something like 119 different matrices that are centered on a factor. So they fixed one factor and they expressed all the other factors together with this. Okay? So these are 2785 GATA1 focus factor peak location, and they look at all the other factors. So whenever you see a red dot, means that in that particular peak that is defined by GATA factor, you find also the other one, okay, also the other factor. So you read this kind of matrix like this. Okay? So whenever you see big dots like this, it's a cluster with GATA. And they found that actually only merging all the experiment with only referred to the GATA one factor, you see that 94 patterns are found, but only some of those are the same in answer as GATA1. Okay, so it's a kind of story. So this is the explanation. So if you take only an answer 1, an answer 2, an answer 3, and blah, 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 and you find only TF1 or TF2, but not, or very, very low, frequent, also the other factors there. Okay, so the combination are defined in some sense. Okay, this is just to show you an enlargement of it. So they try to make 94 focus factor here. You see GATA here. You find dots that are frequent with this June, other GATAs, and not with the other factors there. So it means that has a preference for the cofactor, say. Okay? Oh, this is a long story, just to show you something that we did, and then we finish. Probably, yes. Yes, we finish. Just to... I'm on time. Yes. a story that we ran with other people here in Torino. And this is... you know him, because he's making the... Oh, no, he's making the next year course in bioinformatics. He's a theoretical physicist here in Torino, Michele Casello, and actually is working on genome structures since many, many years, has published a number of relevant papers. And this guy here is a medical doctor that was doing the PhD program with us. Medical doctor, actually made a computational analysis or something, but anyway. Good, and this was my doctor, my former PhD student that actually worked with us for a couple of years, and she went to Barcelona to the CRG, my postdoc period. And the idea was that, okay, we had a set of estrogen receptor binding sites, as you know, to the boring level, I think you mentioned. And what we did is that we take all these peaks that you have when you make cheap seek of estrogen receptor in a breast cancer cell line, that are many, something like several thousands, actually, as a matter of fact. Okay, so. And started to analyze, you remember that in addition to the ERE, so to the estrogen response element, you find also different factors. You remember the sloggers that we have shown before. You don't? Can I go back? Just a minute. Maybe I found it. It's very, very far away, but we will. Okay. This guy. Okay. So when you analyze all the peaks, so all the fragments that are immunoprecipitated by the estrogen receptor, and makes motif discovery analysis inside, you don't only, you find, of course, the ERE is normal. If you don't find it, start to be worried. Again, your experiment, okay? This is normal, okay. So the estrogen receptor element is there, okay. But then you find other frequent companion of the estrogen receptor element, that is this forkhead box here, this AP1 box, this CABP, and this octal box. Yeah, okay, so they are there in the same fragments frequently. And so this Alessandro Testori started to look at the composition. So started to look whether these factors were in the same position as compared to the ERE. And he found, was a very initial observation, he found that they are, for example, the forkhead box was always following the ERE, never before, always the following position. So this made the story, and we started to ask why they have to be like this, they have to be ordered, okay? And one idea that came to our mind was an old paper from an author in the United States, the name is Shapiro, that was studying the, you know, these retroviral elements that we talked about the very first lessons, when we make the genome composition, you remember, that there are these transposable elements. So one idea was that actually these enhancers that we saw with the estrogen receptor could be actually transposons. Okay, so it started to make an overlap. There is a database of the transposable elements that are deposited somewhere, I don't know where. And our peak of estrogen receptor started to make overlap. So what he discovered was that actually a very important fraction of estrogen receptor enhancers are actually transposable elements of the ERV family. you know, ERV family. And this, additionally curious, is that this family of ERVs just spread our genome in the passage from mouse rodents to primates. And if you think about the reproductive biology is completely different in primates than as compared to the rodents, because estrus, mistress. So it's kind of a tricky story. Maybe that we discussed this story with the people. You remember we had a seminars on disposable elements 1 month ago, and they say, yeah, this is a kind of, they call it domestication. That means that a repetitive element like a transposable element is used by the genome to make something. And since many of these ERV, that endogenous retroviral elements, you remember as an acronym, they are coming from retroviruses, so they have LTRs. You remember what LTRs are? They are transcriptional promoters, so they bind some transcription factors. So it makes sense anyway. It's a nice story to, and also it probably explains why these enhancers are the same. So they have the same compositionality of the models. Okay. Have you any question about it? No. You're too tired. Okay. No questions. Tomorrow maybe. Okay. So good. No, tomorrow is Friday. Very good. Have you received my message from the? About the papers and so on. Okay, so this is the following story from next week. And so if you take a read of the... Okay, all this is very well explained in the first review that you have us tested. Very, very clear. I appreciate it. It's from Lambert or something. Very well explained. If you can start to read the other one on promoters also, would be great.